reactor churning. The head is this way. The layout's pretty close to the old Wasps, Caleb replied. A little posher than we had it, he smiled. And probably a lot better in zero gravity. They entered the bathroom. As a Centurion dropship, it was designed to support up to 50 people on the week-long journey between Proxima and Earth. There were multiple stalls, multiple sinks, and a larger common shower.
So you're saying you were on the generation ship Deliverance? Nathan asked.
That's right.
But now you're back here.
Also right.
How?
I came through an Axon portal.
On purpose?
Yes.
Why?
What do you mean?
You had to be able to imagine the best-case scenario for the planet, and know that it would still suck. If I were you, I would have assumed humankind was lost.
Maybe. But I knew humankind wasn't lost.
How?
Caleb pulled at his body armor, separating the alien material at his chest and bringing it down to his waist. Nathan's attention immediately went to a dark, worm-like growth around the Marine's upper right arm. The hunger communicates across the vast distance of their domain using an interdimensional quantum network called the Collective, Caleb explained. He lifted and rotated his right arm. Nathan's breath caught in his throat. The motion revealed that the growth wasn't a growth at all. A pair of small, dark eyes looked out at him from the end of the creature's body, regarding him with an intelligence that made his skin crawl.
This is Ishek, an advocate. They're Relia symbiotes, one of the races they conquered and further engineered, modified to both control and enhance a human counterpart. Typically, the advocate takes what we humans refer to as the alpha position in the relationship, but I managed to get the better of this one.
He paused and smiled.
Though, of course, he doesn't agree with my assessment. His name is Ishek.
Nathan stared at the creature. It shifted slightly on Caleb's arm, a soft chittering squeal escaping from somewhere.
I see, Nathan replied, jaw clenching as he fought to control his sudden anger. Tell me something, Sergeant. How the hell am I supposed to trust a damn thing you say when you have an enemy alien parasite sucking on your arm?
39. Nathan.
That's a good question, Caleb replied. There was no worry in his voice, no concern that Nathan might be able to hurt him if things went sour. That lack of nervousness gave Nathan pause. That's why we're here, Caleb continued. I don't need a shower, but I wanted to show you Ishek in confidence. The other survivors, they'd see an alien wrapped around my arm and lynch me before I could say a word, especially after what just happened with the Jaxcluth. I didn't need to show him to you, but I want to earn your trust. I know we can help one another.
Nathan continued to stare at Ishek. The sight of the thing made him nauseous. He shifted his eyes, meeting Caleb's.
Okay, I'm listening. I came back here for a reason, to deliver a message.
What kind of message?
A solution to the Trife problem, a means to wipe them out.
We already tried that, Nathan said. The poison killed people too.
What?
Sorry to disappoint you, Card, but you're not the first person to come up with that idea. We've had over 200 years to work on it, and we couldn't get a solution that didn't also kill humans.
This one might be different.
It might not. Have you tested it?
The Trife are specifically engineered for each planet and species they're deployed against. The only way to test it was to bring it here. I can't believe my source would send me back with a solution that would kill both human and Trife.
You said it, but you don't sound convinced.
Caleb paused, jaw flexing, eyes dropping.
Damn you, Valentine, he whispered, shaking his head.
He looked up at Nathan again.
Fine. In all honesty, I'm not 100% sure it isn't the same solution. All I have is a data file jammed into my brain. I'm not even sure how it's supposed to be extracted.
Where did you get it?
Dr. Riley Valentine, Class A bitch. But she sacrificed herself to get her research back to Earth, so there's that. I'm supposed to deliver it to Proxima.
Nathan's eyes narrowed.
He didn't trust anything having to do with Proxima.
Anyone in particular?
I don't think she knew anyone specific who lived over 200 years, Caleb replied flatly.
So how do you know who to give it to? How do you know you can trust them?
I always assumed I would hand it over to whoever's in charge of the planet, or whoever's in charge of their military.
Nathan shook his head.
Not a good idea.
Why not?
Let me tell you something about Proxima. The Proxima government decided Earth is a shithole converted into what they consider an alien ant farm and populated by ignorant savages. They see this place as a testing ground for their experiments, not their home away from home, if you know what I mean.
They gave up on Earth?
That's right, big time. Except where it suits them. Eden Rise, for instance. We've been trading with them for over half a century, even though their own laws make the trades illegal.
Trading what?
They bring us raw materials and we turn them into weapons. High-end, high-tech weapons. We keep some of them for ourselves and pass the rest back.
Caleb's eyebrows lowered.
Wait a second. I was just out in the field with you.
Other than your powered armor, I didn't see any firepower we didn't have 200 years ago. Your plasma cannons carry a bit more punch, but it's not an innovation.
We never kept our cash inside the city. Too risky if our contacts ever decided to renege on our agreement and found a way to get past the shield.
You could have used those weapons today.
Nathan sighed.
Tell me about it. Nobody figured on some giant tentacled monster showing up behind every damn trife this side of the Mississippi.
Maybe we should have.
You couldn't have known. Your shield took a hell of a beating.
I'm glad we got some people out in time. With your help. You saved a lot of lives today.
Good. I hope that helps you trust me.
Who reprogrammed the shield to kill the Jaxcluth?
Not me.
I knew you seemed different. Now I guess I know why.
I'm going to trust you, Caleb. I don't have much left to lose, and I'm desperate for someone who knows what the hell is going on out here.
Thank you.
I wasn't done, Nathan interrupted. You need to trust me, too. Whatever's happening out there, whatever your mission is, you can't just go running to Proxima with everything you know. Like I told you, the government doesn't care about Earth, and any problems we cause down here and bring to them are usually met with stiff reprisal. Do you understand?
Caleb nodded.
Good. There's another faction on Proxima called the Trust. They're a crime syndicate. Bad news. They're the group we've been trading with all these years. Like I said, illegal. But it gets better than that. The Centurion Space Force and the Trust are both headed up by the same man, General Aaron Hyrie. I don't quite have that bastard figured out yet, but he's the reason I'm down here instead of up there.
You're originally from Proxima?
Affirmative. I was a Centurion Space Force pilot until I got too close to something the Trust didn't want me to see. They tried to kill me. Fortunately, I'm a hard man to kill.
I get that feeling.
My orders were to deliver the data to a military dark ops group that was dealing with the Relia and Axon invasions before the Trife ever came to Earth.
Does that mean anything to you?
Are you suggesting there were aliens on Earth before the Trife arrived?
That one threw me for a loop too, but yes, that's what I was told.
Nathan stared at Caleb in silence. He could hardly believe it.
If there's a dark ops branch on Proxima, they never made themselves known to me.
That's who I want to talk to, but we don't have time right now.
You said things were going to get worse.
Worse how?
The Jaxcluth who attacked your city? We're only one group. As near as we can tell, there are thousands of them emerging planet-wide.
What?
That's not the worst part.
You're kidding.
The Relia are divided under 12 siblings born of the first Relia hundreds of thousands of years ago. It's their responsibility to carry out the destiny of the hunger and conquer the entire universe from end to end. Earth is a prize they all want to claim, because whoever controls it will have a better foothold against the Axon. From what Ishek and I have been able to learn, we're confident that one of the most powerful of the Relia, Nyarlath, is making a move on the planet. The Jaxcluth are her vanguard.
Vanguard against what?
Have you seen a lot of the planet, Sergeant?
Other than Eden Rise, there's only one other place I know that can put up even a hint of a fight. Nathan froze as soon as the words left his mouth. His heart thundered in his chest.
What is it? Caleb asked. I have to warn him.
Warn who?
I need to find Pyro. We leave in 48 minutes, right after I talk to my soldiers.
Roger that, Nathan. Warn who?
Sheriff Duke, Nathan said, turning to leave. He glanced back over his shoulder.
And you're wrong, Sergeant. You do need a shower. You're covered in alien guts, and no offense, but you stink.
He hurried from the head across the dropship and out through the hold, sprinting across the deck at full speed and leaving a very confused Caleb Card behind.
40. Hayden. Hayden looked out through the open side of the Iroquois, watching the city of Sinisco approach below. It was like most of the cities in the area, ravaged by war, beaten and crumbling, but not broken. The outskirts were lined with streets filled with dilapidated buildings and rusted wrecks of old cars, shattered glass, chunks of rock and other debris left over from the first invasion. Vegetation crept in through the cracks of worn asphalt, cement, and concrete. In some places, the weeds took on a surreal beauty that captured Hayden's imagination every time he saw them. To the north, the detonated halves of the Golden Gate Bridge rested on opposite shores, while the central expanse poked up from the bay. To the east, the Oakland Bay Bridge was in a similar state, the overall destruction cutting the city off from trife attack on three sides. His eyes turned toward the northeast section of the city, toward home. The destruction lessened, the vegetation faded. The buildings, while old, showed increasing signs of stability and improving conditions. A wall had been erected along the perimeter, composed of concrete and old cars, tracing Interstate 80 from the Bay Bridge to Route 100 and following it north to Black Point. It was all that remained of the city, and it was more than enough for the survivors who lived there. Or it had been enough. The loss of Haven and La Vega had brought thousands of refugees north, and he could see them too, camping just inside the walls. They had crews working overtime to test the stability of more buildings to renovate for the new residents to have safe places to live. It wasn't a fast process, especially considering the size of the influx. It would take months to get them all adequately housed, maybe years. Not that any of them were complaining. They had been lucky to escape north with their lives and were fortunate to be in one of the only two places Hayden knew had walls of any kind. There was another benefit. A lot of the refugees wanted to be UWT law officers. They wanted to learn to defend themselves, their families, and the rest of the survivors. They wanted to stand up and fight against the threat that had chased them here and for the cause they had come to believe in. Hayden's cause. Peace, security, justice, freedom. Simple tenets that were easy to name and harder to achieve, but they were working on it. The helicopter started its descent, dropping among a handful of buildings under repairs and landing in the street beside the tallest of the intact structures. Old documentation had informed them the building used to be called the Transamerica Pyramid. 260 meters tall and shaped the way its name suggested, it rose above almost everything in the city, the newly restored light in the crown jewel at the top, a beacon for the refugees to follow. It was the home of the United Western Territory government, the main headquarters for law, and the most extensive and advanced science and research center on the west coast of the former United States, if not the entire globe. Of course, the trife problem wasn't localized to the states, but Hayden had enough to worry about here to give too much thought to the rest of the planet. Judging by the Relia interest in this part of the world, he had a feeling they had fared significantly better than some other places. It was a mixed blessing, to be sure. Deputy Fry was waiting at the landing area when the chopper touched down. He hurried over to the helicopter, staying low to avoid the diminishing downwash so he could meet Hayden and the others as they exited. A second group of deputies waited nearby to take the bodies of the fallen.
Sheriff, Chief Deputy Hicks,
Fry said in greeting as Hayden and Hicks climbed out of the helicopter.
Deputy Fry, Hayden said. Where's the governor?
In the lab.
Hayden shook his head.
Doc Hess told her to stay out of the lab.
Sheriff, I think you'd have better luck pacifying a trife.
Salino, you're with me, Hayden said. Hicks, get your people rested. I'm not sure what comes next, but I want you ready when it happens.
Roger, Sheriff, Hicks said.
Hayden and Salino headed away from the helicopter and up the steps of the pyramid, while Hicks took the Rangers to the armory to shed their equipment and then to the barracks for some downtime. The ride north had been quick but tense, the entire unit stressed by what they had experienced. Hayden didn't blame them. He was stressed too. The new aliens were one thing. The strange hologram was something else. Its threat of war and its arrogant confidence had left him shaken. For as much as the UWT had accomplished against the Trife, they had no chance against the true might of the Hunger. But the might of the Hunger was coming, and sooner than he had expected. Inside the building, the two men crossed the lobby to the bank of lifts at the rear. Hayden tapped the control pad and a set of doors slid open, one of the cabs already waiting. They boarded and descended to sub-level 3, exiting into an underground parking garage that had been converted to a research and development lab. Dozens of computers and displays of various shapes, sizes, and ages sat on tables spread across the open floor, while bundles of wires snaked away toward the corner. A handful of engineers perched on an assortment of seats, from an aluminum stool to an old wooden dining chair. Some ran programs that sifted through data stores, while others used small tools to try to repair more of the machines. Almost all of it was made before the war, scavenged by the UWT's collectors or acquired from scavengers via trade. More equipment was always coming in, assessed and either rebuilt or used as parts to restore other devices. Hayden didn't see Natalia with the other engineers. He turned toward the southern section of the lab. His eyes crossed over a cluster of computer terminals fronting a half-dozen large machines that Dr. Hess and Natalia had been using in recent biological and genetic research and testing. And then his gaze passed over a makeshift divider to a terminal resting beside a motorized chair salvaged from a dentist's office. The divider was composed of individual wood crates, each one containing a mechanical limb, augments similar to Hayden's arms, while the terminal and chair were used to install and program the prosthetics. Another machine rested to the right of the Botter station that Natalia called a neural interlink. From the outside, it was little more than a metal frame wrapped around a plastic seat, but the exterior simplicity hid the interior complexity. Originally designed to allow humans to communicate with the Goliaths, it was the result of years of work by some of Proxima's brightest scientists. They still used it for the Goliaths, but now they had a secondary. It was a dangerous but potentially invaluable use for the technology. Hayden spotted Natalia in the seat and reacted with a deep sigh. Dismayed but not surprised, he glanced at Salino, who knew to wait while Hayden approached the interlink. Wires ran from a box at the side of the frame to electrodes attached to different parts of Natalia's body beneath her clothes. A wired cap and a pair of bulky goggles hid most of her face, leaving only the tips of her short black hair, small turned-up nose, and jaw exposed. Chief Engineer Sean Lutz was sitting at a computer terminal across from the interlink, monitoring the output from the system. A tall, rail-thin man with wild hair and a scruffy face, he stiffened when he noticed Hayden approaching.
Sheriff Duke, he said. You're back early.
I radioed that I was on my way, Hayden replied. I thought Nat would be waiting outside.
The system output froze. Natalia reached up, grabbing the goggles and lifting them off her head. She looked at Hayden with apologetic brown eyes.
Hayden, she said, before you say anything, I have a good reason for being here.
Do you? Hayden replied, unconvinced.
Natalia hung the goggles on a waiting hook and removed the cap while he knelt beside her, reaching under her shirt and tenderly peeling the electrodes off her skin.
I almost lost you the last time you used this thing.
She leaned over, putting her forehead against his.
I know. I wasn't using it. We were collecting some diagnostics.
Preparing it for use, Hayden translated.
Caught, Natalia admitted. It's been weeks, Hayden. I'm fine now, back to normal.
I'm not eager to see that change again anytime soon.
We may not have a choice, all things considered.
Hayden stood and offered his hand. Natalia took it, letting him pull her out of the interlink. They embraced for a moment.
Does this mean I'm not in trouble? Lutz asked. I was only following the governor's orders.
We'll see, Hayden replied. He locked eyes with Natalia. We need to talk. 41. Hayden.
Nick, can you go upstairs and tell Heather I'll be up in another hour or so? Natalia asked.
Deputy Salino smiled and glanced at Hayden, who nodded his approval.
Of course, Governor. I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Salino turned and hurried for the stairs, not wanting to wait for a lift.
He seems pretty eager, Hayden said, watching him go.
He and Heather are seeing each other.
By seeing, you mean...
Yes, Hayden. You sound like such an old man sometimes.
Hayden smiled.
Kids these days, if they aren't out teasing Trife, they're making out in the shadows of ruined buildings.
Natalia punched him playfully in the arm.
Like we never ran into the splits to make out.
Feels like ancient history.
Because it is. I'm sorry about Nan, Cortez, and Rollins. They were good people.
They were.
Do you want me to come with you?
We can notify their families after we talk. We have a problem, Nat. A big problem.
I know, you told me before you headed up from Tijuana.
And you reacted by going to the lab to prep the interlink. That's a separate problem in itself.
Somebody has to do it.
It doesn't have to be you.
They reached the lift banks. Hayden tapped on the pad. The one he had taken to the garage was still waiting, and they stepped in.
What floor?
Let's go to 42.
Are you sure?
They just finished the rebuild last week. I know we talked about keeping the UWT offices down on 10, but I've been thinking a lot about that. We need to go back up, if only to show we won't be cowed by adversity.
Hayden tapped the floor on the control pad and looked at his wife. The last governor of the UWT had died up there during an attack that had cost nearly 50 lives and left most of the floor in ruins. It was still a painful memory for a lot of people in Sanisco.
You know, I appreciate the symbolism, but can it wait until we figure this crisis out?
If that's how the sheriff wants it?
It is.
Natalia smiled.
Okay.
So, the interlink,
Hayden pressed as the lift ascended.
It doesn't have to be you. Let Lutz calibrate it from the hot seat while you run the diagnostics.
I'm impressed. You almost sounded like you knew what you were talking about there.
Hayden laughed. Come on, Nat, I'm serious. That thing nearly killed you.
Which is why it has to be me. I'm not putting someone else in that seat to die. I can't ask anyone to do something I won't do myself. And besides, I already have experience in the collective. I spoke to Shub Negu. And I survived. Even Doc Hess said by all accounts I should be dead.
That's not something to be proud of.
But it still means something. My mind is strong enough to withstand the pressures of the collective. That seems to be more important than ever, considering what you encountered out there. New aliens that make the Trife look like pansies?
Ugliest things I've ever seen. And they grew so damn fast. I'm nervous to think what would happen if one of them had gotten to a nest.
Ironic that they're Trife eaters, isn't it?
I think they'll eat anything they encounter. Besides, you know the Relia feed on fear. Those things were definitely frightening.
But you killed them all.
I killed one deposit of them. Their mother made it sound like there are plenty more.
Their mother?
The lift stopped, the doors sliding open. Hayden and Natalia stepped out onto the 42nd floor. It still had a smell of fresh plaster and cement, and the windows Proxima had provided still glistened in the light of bright LEDs.
They did fantastic work, Hayden said, scanning the room. They picked all this up from books?
We have some really talented people in the city, Natalia replied. But it wasn't without some trial and error. The flubs were cleaned and redone.
The room was open and large and led back to a second office and a conference room adjacent to an open-air patio. Natalia led Hayden toward it.
I skipped over that part during the ride. I was still processing the whole interaction. It was strange, Nat. Real strange.
He reached into his pocket and withdrew the projector, holding it out to her.
A projector?
She guessed, surprising him with her ability to identify it.
You've seen something like it before?
No, but the crystal in the center gave it away.
I didn't even notice the crystal,
Hayden admitted, looking closer at it. The hologram was a middle-aged woman dressed like a lab tech, maybe like someone who worked in the building where we found the egg sacs. But she spoke to us like she was in the present, only kind of stilted.
Stilted?
Maybe that's not the best word for it. I don't know, it was like she learned to speak by watching old movies. Bad dialogue. Does that make any sense?
Not really, but it probably doesn't matter.
They reached the glass doors to the patio, which slid open silently at their approach.
It matters because it was out of the ordinary, and it matters because of what she said and how she said it. She was arrogant. Confident.
If she's Aurelia like Shirath, why wouldn't she be both those things? Especially if you're right about there being more of those creatures.
Exactly. Like I said, a big problem. And we have no idea what the consequences are or what we're about to come up against. I don't think it begins and ends with tentacled monsters.
They walked across the patio to the edge of the building. The air was cooler up high, and the city small below.
What do you suggest, Sheriff?
Natalia asked, looking out over the city.
How do we keep these people safe?
Hayden shook his head.
I've been thinking about that since I got on the chopper. I don't have an answer, and it pisses me off.
I've been thinking about it too, Natalia said. Which is why I was working on the interlink. Caleb Card,
she said, almost to herself.
What?
Do you remember? When we connected to the Collective, Caleb Card was there, a human on the Relia Comm network. He's here on Earth somewhere.
You don't know that.
I'm pretty sure. He was close. I could sense it.
Let's say you're right. How will finding him help us?
For one, he must know quite a bit about the Relia to be on their comm network, don't you think?
Pause.
For another, he still has access to it, which means he has access to information. Maybe he can tell us more about what the Hunger is planning.
We know what they're planning.
I mean how? Like you said, beyond tentacle monsters. That can't be all there is.
Assuming you're right on both counts, we don't know how to find him.
Natalia took Hayden's hand, turning to face him. Their eyes met. Hayden didn't like the look in hers.
Yes, you do.
Hayden shook his head.
Nat, you have no way of knowing if that will work. You could wind up dead, and still no Caleb Card, and considering we're making some big assumptions on his usefulness, that's not worth the risk.
I hear you, Hayden. I do. But what are our options? We barely handled the last problem. We aren't equipped to deal with this. Look at what we've built here, and think about what we already lost. These people depend on us. We can't afford to play it safe, you know that. I know you do. And I understand. Halya, Ginny, they give you something. But they also take something away. You want to play it safe. You want to stay away from risk. But living on Earth isn't a promise of anything. We could have gone to Proxima. We decided to stay here. We have a responsibility.
Hayden nodded. I do know that. And I'm willing to make any sacrifice necessary to protect these people, except you.
We don't have room for exceptions. Love doesn't change that.
Hayden sighed, turning to look out at the city.
She was right. When wasn't she?
We'd need to find Aurelia with a bidirectional communication structure. A full ick. Hess said a trife won't do. They can only receive.
The Relia all went into hiding after I took out Shirath.
They can't survive here without feeding. And you're the sheriff of the United Western Territories. There has to be a lead somewhere you can follow.
Right. I'll put Salino on it.
Put Hicks on it,
Natalia suggested.
Why? Hayden smiled, remembering Heather.
Oh. Yeah, I guess he deserves a little break. I'll ping Hicks when we get downstairs.
Hayden looked down at his blood-stained armor.
I need to get out of these clothes. I can only imagine how bad I smell.
It's pretty bad, Natalia admitted.
She put her hand on his face.
We'll do this together. I won't let anything tear down what we've built here.
Me neither, Hayden agreed.
I know. We have some hard business to take care of. And then you owe me the rest of the night.
The pleasure is mine, Governor. It's just a shame it has to be mixed with so much pain.
That's life, Hayden. Especially here.
Pause that. Let's go.
42. Hayden. Hayden changed in the law office, trading his stained and worn armor for his typical sheriff's uniform. A dark blue collared shirt, black pants, tan leather boots, ammo belt around his waist, and two revolvers holstered beneath his arms, all under a long leather duster. He pinned the silver star-shaped comm to his shirt collar. A larger, slightly melted plastic star was already pinned on the outside of the duster. The star had been given to him by a homeless, hungry, desperate child, and was a constant reminder to him of who and what he was fighting for. He asked Hicks to begin looking into recent reports for a potential match to a Koron modus operandi. Like all Relia, the worm-like parasites required the pheromones and chemicals emitted during high-stress situations to survive, and there was a good chance they would do something illegal to achieve that. The only question was whether or not anyone would report it. Hayden and his deputies had worked hard to create a system of trust within the UWT, but too many years of lawlessness and martial control had made a lot of the people cautious. Sometimes too cautious. Hayden didn't blame them for that. They had reason to be afraid. But they also had reason to hope. He was doing his best to guide them in that direction. Hayden and Natalia went from the barracks out into the city. Many of the residents outside waved and said hello as they passed or walked with them a ways to talk about the city or the UWT as a whole. Some asked for things, and some just wanted to say thank you. One survivor from La Vega cursed them for their misfortune and the loss of her home, and was quickly brought aside by other residents looking to help comfort her. Natalia broke away from Hayden then, joining the group to deal with the heartbroken woman while he continued through the city. As governor, it was difficult for her to manage all of the people who had lost something, but most handled the loss with resignation. It was rare for someone to lash out, but Natalia said she preferred it to silence. It was a symbol of the hope they were trying to bring to the survivors, a display of the belief that their lives shouldn't end so easily or have so little value. Three dead officers typically meant three grieving families, but Cortez had no one besides his brothers and sisters-in-law. Nan and Rollins both had families in Cenisco. Nan had parents and a brother, while Rollins had a wife and child. Hayden knew his family would be harder to face, not only for their loss, but also for the reminder of what it could cost his family. He entered the apartment building three blocks from the pyramid, climbing the stairs to the third floor. A couple of people there offered somber greetings. They already knew if they saw him in one of the apartments alone or with Natalia, it meant someone in law had died. It left him feeling more depressed than usual. He was like the angel of death coming to deliver the worst of news. But somebody had to do it, and these people were his responsibility. He found Nan's apartment and knocked on the door. Most families in Cenisco lived together, at least until marriage and new families pulled them apart. Nan's brother Carlo opened the door.
"Sheriff Duke," he said, his face beginning to pale the moment he saw Hayden.
"Carlo," Hayden replied, his chest constricting.
"Are your folks here?"
"Yes."
He moved aside.
Come in, Sheriff.
Deputy Nan's mother heard her son, and she came out of her bedroom with tears already in her eyes. Hayden fought to hold back his emotion. He would rather face 1,000 trife alone than do this. Nan's father emerged behind her mother. He was more stoic, his face flat.
I'm sorry, Hayden said. He didn't need to say much more than that. They knew why he was here.
She died to save her fellow deputies. She died a hero.
Mrs. Nan came over to him and threw her arms around him, sobbing into his chest. He held her while she cried. Mr. Nan stood in front of him, watching them, fighting to bury his emotions and mostly succeeding, but not completely. Carlo put his arm over his mother's shoulders. He had tears in his eyes.
What happened, Sheriff?
A trife queen attacked us, Hayden replied.
A queen? Nan's father said, surprised.
That's right. We lost 2 others in the fight.
You were lucky you made it out alive.
Hayden heard the accusation in the man's voice. He didn't blame him. Why should he be alive when his daughter was dead? Hayden asked himself that question all the time.
We made it out alive because of Kyrie, Hayden said. She gave her life for us.
Thank you for coming yourself,
Carlo said, gently trying to pull his mother away.
I'm sure you have a lot of other things to do.
I wish I didn't, Hayden said as Mrs. Nan released him. Of course, you have the full support of the UWT. Whatever you need, please don't hesitate to ask.
Thank you, Sheriff,
Carlo said.
Good night.
Hayden nodded, backing toward the door. They were going to be pissed at him for a while. He understood. He left in silence, closing his eyes when he heard Deputy Nan's mother begin to wail. He wiped away the tears as he headed back down the stairs and out into the street. 43. Hayden.
Dad!
Hayden smiled and knelt as Ginny rushed over to him, taking her in his arms. She hugged him tightly and kissed his cheek.
Good to see you too, Hayden said.
He looked past Ginny to the sofa, where Halia's caretaker Heather was sitting with Halia asleep in her lap. Deputy Salino sat beside her.
I think they're in love,
Ginny whispered into his ear.
I think you're right, Hayden replied. How are you, little darling?
Good. You should bring me on your next mission with you. I'm useful.
I know you are, but you're more useful here. Did any trife attack the city today?
No.
See? All you.
Ginny laughed.
I'm serious.
So am I.
You both look very serious, Natalia said. Thanks for staying late, Heather.
Of course, Governor,
Heather replied. She was young and a little pudgy, with a pretty face that glowed when she smiled, and the perfect patient demeanor for dealing with an infant and a precocious tween.
Anything I can do to help.
I'll take things from here,
Natalia said, going over to her and picking up Halia.
Why don't you and Deputy Salino go enjoy the rest of the evening?
Deputy Salino laughed.
Are you two suggesting these two aren't enjoyable?
Not at all. But adults need a chance to enjoy adult things, too. I'm an adult, Ginny said. Close enough, anyway. And if you're talking about the adult things I think you're talking about, there's nothing you can say I haven't already heard, and probably a lot of it I've already seen.
Hayden glanced at Natalia. It was easy to forget Ginny had practically raised herself on the streets of Digo. She had also risked her life to save Hayden's. Not the average 12-year-old.
Right. Deputy Salino said, face turning red. Well, that wasn't what I had in mind, but they are showing Star Wars at the rec center.
He looked at Heather.
Interested?
She nodded.
Sure.
Engineer Lil fixed a projector someone brought in, Salino explained. High definition for the first time.
Sounds great, Hayden said.
Can I go?
Ginny asked, looking at him. It also still took him by surprise when she asked for permission to do things. She technically didn't need permission. He and Natalia weren't really her parents,
but she had chosen them, and she wanted their approval. She wanted to feel cared for and about, and he did love her.
"Try to stay out of Heather and Nick's hair," Natalia said, laughing. "I'll find someone else to buck," Jenny said.
"And be back by 10, Hayden said. "Got it?"
"Pause."
She looked at Heather and Deputy Salino.
"You two coming?"
Heather laughed and got to her feet, joined by the deputy.
"We'll keep an eye on her," Salino said. "Or maybe she'll keep an eye on us."
"Bye, Mom," Jenny said. "Bye, Dad. I love you."
"Love you too,"
Natalia and Hayden replied. The trio left the apartment. Natalia sat down with Halya on her arm. Hayden sat next to her, putting his arm around her. She leaned into his chest.
"Do you hear that?" Hayden asked.
"No."
"Exactly. I don't get enough quiet time with my wife anymore."
"It's nice, isn't it?"
"Pause."
Hayden kissed the top of Natalia's head.
"In case I haven't told you lately, I love you."
"I love you too, Sheriff," she replied. "Always have, always will."
He put his free arm around her, putting his hand on Halya's back. They sat in comfortable silence for a while.
"You know," Natalia said, shifting slightly, "Hal should sleep for a couple more hours. We have some time to ourselves."
"What are you suggesting, Governor Duke?"
"Political scandal. Governor found in bed with sheriff?"
Hayden laughed.
"I want to, more than anything. Especially now. But I'm beat, Nat, and you deserve better than that."
She nodded, putting her head back on his chest.
"You need to tell the Relia to stop sending tentacle monsters to kill you. Tell them it leaves you too drained to make love to your wife."
"You'd be the one to tell them," Hayden replied. "Do you think it would work?"
"Somehow I doubt it."
"Why don't we put Halya to bed? Maybe I'll find a second wind if we relax together for a while."
"I'm fine with whatever we do right now, so long as we do it together. Just don't lose hope, Hayden."
"I won't if you don't," he replied.
"Deal."
Hayden stood up and took Hal from Natalia, carrying her to her room beside the master at the back of their apartment. They lived inside the pyramid on the 9th floor and had a view of the bay and the Golden Gate Bridge. He laid his daughter in the crib, leaning over and kissing her forehead.
"Daddy loves you."
Halya didn't react. She was sound asleep.
"Mommy loves you too,"
Natalia said, kissing her from the other side of the crib. They turned and headed out of the room together. The badge on Hayden's collar flashed.
"Sheriff Duke," Hicks said. "Do you copy?"
"I copy," Hayden said, glancing at Natalia.
"Do you have something?" "I do."
"That was fast," Natalia said.
"Sorry to bother you," Hicks said. "I know you wanted some downtime with your family."
"What have you got?" Hayden asked.
"A farmer came in about 10 minutes ago. Says his wife is missing."
"Trife?" Natalia asked.
"Governor Duke," Hicks said, hearing her voice. "We don't think so. He says he didn't see, hear, or smell anything, but he did find what looks like a torn strip of cloth from her shirt out in the field where she was tending crops. I can look into it, Sheriff. I just thought you should know."
"No," Hayden said. "I'm on. Contact Bronson. We'll meet at the chopper in 20.
"Roger that, Sheriff. Hicks out."
Hayden looked at Natalia.
"Sorry, love. Even if it isn't a Koron, if he didn't find a body, she's probably alive and in trouble."
"I know. I want you to go. Just be safe, okay?"
"You know me. Tell Jenny and Hal I'm sorry I didn't have more time for them. If we can wrap this up quick, maybe we can salvage a few hours."
"One thing at a time, Sheriff."
"Pause."
Hayden kissed her.
"Maybe we can salvage something, too. Something newsworthy."
Natalia laughed.
"I look forward to it. Now go."
Hayden kissed her again and hurried out the door. 44. Nathan.
Nathan had just enough time to find his own shower and fresh clothes before the hour was up. Fortunately, one of the officers' quarters on the carrier had already been designated for his twin and stocked with both utilities and dress uniforms for the General of Edenrise. He emerged from the island of the USS George H.W. Bush with 5 minutes to spare. Pyro walked beside him, dressed in combat armor and carrying her helmet against her hip. A small selection of soldiers walked behind them in combat armor of their own, the most elite of what remained. They marched across the deck, past the rotting corpse of the Jaxcluth, to where the rest of the surviving soldiers had gathered, only a short distance from the dropship. There were only about 100 of them in total, a depressingly small group of men and women, many of them sporting bandaged arms or foreheads or other minor injuries. Even so, they came to stiff attention when Nathan approached, standing proudly for their leader. Nathan walked past them, climbing onto the back of the resting Badger to be seen by all. He had a comm in his ear that would broadcast out to Pyro's helmet, which in turn would transmit to the Bush's comm across the Truxton. She had managed to locate 2 surviving engineers to help her set the system up, as well as check on Nathan's armor and effect simple repairs. A similar number of soldiers on the other side waited for his instruction. He looked to his right, finding the other carrier floating 0.5 kilometer away. Both ships were still cruising toward open water, and from there, north to what he hoped might become a temporary safe haven.
"Space Force,"
he snapped, getting their attention.
"Hoorah!"
they shouted back in reply. It was pitiful compared to their last muster when nearly 6,000 soldiers were organized across the field.
"I'll keep this short and simple."
He looked out at the soldiers, able to pick them out by faces.
"We lost a lot of good people today, both members of our family and citizens of our city. We're tired, hurting, on the run. But we're here. We're together. And with your help, we can restore Edenrise."
"Hoorah!"
"Early counts show 6,000 here on the Bush, another 2,000 on the Truxton, 8,000 survivors, 8,000 people who are still depending on us to provide protection and leadership in the days ahead. I can't tell you those days will be easy. As you've seen, the enemy is upping the ante and escalating the fight. You know what we say to that?"
"Fight back!"
the soldiers shouted.
"That's right. We'll fight back. We'll protect our own and we'll rebuild. I see Lieutenant Locke." "Lieutenant."
"Sir, yes, sir,"
Locke said, remaining at attention. He was short and muscled, his uniform bloodstained, a bandage over his left eye. Wounded but present and eager to serve.
"From what I can tell, you're the 2nd-ranking officer on this ship. That means the Bush is your responsibility."
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir."
"Captain Coy is the ranking officer on the Truxton. He's in charge of both his ship and the entirety of the settlement. Understood?"
"Yes, sir,"
Locke replied.
"As you know, both ships are home to well-equipped armories. It is the duty of every remaining Space Force soldier to continue to defend these ships with their lives. They are our home for the immediate future. Locke, Coy, I want you both to designate units to begin conscripting from the civilians and teaching them how to use our available weapons. The only people who are exempt are those too injured or elderly to fight, and no more than 1 parent or potential caretaker for any children who are newly orphaned. Understood?"
"Yes, General,"
both Locke and Coy replied.
"Good. Your orders are to head north. Stay well clear of the shore. These new alien creatures aren't affected by water the way the Trifar, and will likely attack if they get visual. We're relatively safe out to sea, but we can't stay out here forever."
"Sir," Locke said, "what about the weapons cache?"
Nathan expected the question.
"As you can see, I have a unit suited up and ready to go. I'll be joining them in a recon of the weapons cache. If at all possible, we'll begin to recover some of the ordnance to assist with defense."
"Yes, sir,"
Locke replied.
"How long will you be gone, sir?"
"I don't know. As long as it takes."
He paused a moment, waiting to see if anyone else would ask any questions. They didn't.
"Most of you came to Edenrise from outside because you were looking for something better than mere survival. Losing the city and the protection of the energy shield is a blow to all of us. But Edenrise is bigger than a place. It's bigger than a shield. Its value is in its people. All of you. If you think of something that should be done, bring it to Locke or Coy. If you see something that needs to be done, do it. It's vital that we remain focused on the tenets that made Eden Rise great. Loyalty. Honesty. Trust. Freedom. I'm counting on all of you.
Hoorah!
Locke, you have the ship.
Sir, yes, sir,
Locke said. Nathan jumped down from his perch on the Badger. Locke was already shouting orders, finding his next in command and reorganizing the soldiers into units. He smiled as he headed to where the unit he'd gathered was standing. Pyro came up beside him as he walked.
Nice speech, General, she said.
I didn't know I had it in me, Nathan replied. Liberators, with me. He passed the unit, led by Sergeant Walt, a broad woman with a large tribal tattoo over the left side of her face. It was a new designation, one he had based on the USSF logo and its meaning to him. Freedom, perseverance, strength, power. He hoped the small group could live up to the name. They filed in behind him, tailing him into the dropship. Caleb was already waiting for them in the cargo hold. He had cleaned up well, a model physical specimen in the utilities he had found.
Sergeant Card, Nathan said.
Caleb came to attention, submitting himself as subordinate to him. Nathan motioned to the cart Private Jeffs was pushing.
I've got combat armor for you. I trust you know how to use it?
Caleb smiled.
Yes, sir.
Good. I'm also promoting you to colonel. We need a clean chain of command.
As you say, sir, Caleb replied, a slightly amused look on his face.
Liberators, you've already met Colonel Carr down in the field. He saved all your lives.
Yes, sir,
the Liberators replied.
Welcome to the team, Sergeant Walt said.
Caleb stared at her for a moment, hesitating before nodding.
Thank you, Sergeant.
Time's wasting, Pyro said. Welcome back aboard, Colonel Card. General, permission to prep for launch.
Granted. Sergeant Walt, get your gear stowed and ready. Colonel Card with me.
Caleb followed Nathan up the stairs to the main deck.
What's the situation, General?
Caleb asked once they were clear of the unit.
The soldiers below know me as General James Stacker. I prefer to stay that way.
Roger that.
They also don't know about Sheriff Duke. I can't keep them from finding out, but I prefer to leave them in the dark as long as possible. I don't expect trouble under the circumstances, but it's better to be discreet.
Agreed.
We'll head to the weapons cache first. With any luck, the area will be clear and we can recover some of the more advanced ordnance before heading west. We used to have a comm link to Sinisco, but it went down with the city.
Understood, General.
Caleb paused.
Is there something you want to say? Nathan asked.
A couple of things, Caleb admitted. I sensed another human on the collective a couple of months back. A woman, I think. I couldn't quite reach into her to tell who she was or where she came from. Do you know anything about that?
Nathan shook his head.
I barely understand what the collective is. But if it requires any kind of technical know-how, it probably originated in Sinisco. Sheriff Duke's wife, Natalia, is one of the smartest people I've ever met. What's your other question?
It's more of a statement. Sergeant Walt is a Koron.
Nathan froze, staring at Caleb.
What exactly does that mean?
It means she's infected by a Aurelia creature similar to Ishek. The advocates were engineered from the Koron, an evolved iteration. I'm not sure what it's doing here or what its intentions are.
Does it know about Ishek?
I don't think so. Fortunately, we learned how to block out the nascent connection to the collective. It's sort of like putting a password on a computer network.
Then how did you recognize it?
Like I said, Ishek is an evolved version. We're a little more sensitive. We could probably break into it and determine its motives.
Or we can drop her out of the hold from 10 kilometers up, Nathan said.
He had decided to accept Caleb based on what he had done to help Eden Rise. He wasn't ready to start taking in every Relia refugee they came across.
It's better to be discreet, Caleb replied, using his words against him. She can't cause any trouble without me knowing it, and I'd prefer a chance to talk to her.
I just thought it was important that you were aware.
I understand.
Nathan nodded, then hesitated a moment, considering.
I'll follow your lead on this, Caleb. You know a hell of a lot more about it than I do. I appreciate your trust. Pull Walt aside when we lift off. It'll take about an hour to get to the weapons cache.
That far away? Caleb asked.
You can't just leave your most advanced ordnance sitting out in the open where anyone can find it now, can you?
No, sir.
You have my permission to handle Walt however you need. Find out what you need to find out. Whatever it takes.
Then he turned and walked away. 45. Caleb. Caleb was sitting next to Sergeant Walt in the bow of the dropship as it lifted off from the USS George H.W. Bush, ascending rapidly enough to press him back into his seat. He smiled subconsciously at the liftoff, remembering the many times he had made similar maneuvers on the way to or from an infected zone. The quick acceleration only lasted a dozen seconds before the ship leveled off, the ride flattening out.
ETA 48 minutes, Stacker said over the loudspeaker.
Caleb glanced over at Walt. She was staring straight ahead, a slightly sick look on her face.
First jump? He asked.
She looked at him and nodded.
I've never been airborne before.
You get used to it. The secret is to remember to breathe.
That's all? Just remember to breathe?
She doesn't need to breathe.
That wasn't entirely true. The Koron inside her could keep her alive for an extended period without breathing, but not indefinitely.
Simple. In any case, we're level for now. You're safe until we drop.
I can't wait.
I was hoping we could head somewhere to talk in private, Caleb said. I'm new to Eden Rise. Actually, I only arrived while the city was under attack. I could use some debriefing on how things work around here.
You seem like you've already got in pretty good with the general, Corporal Hotch said, overhearing him. He made you a colonel so you could boss us around.
And so you would show some respect, Caleb said, sharpening his tone of voice. Why don't you drop and give me 50, Corporal?
What? Hotch said.
Now?
Caleb pointed to the space between the seats.
Right there, right now.
Hotch's face paled, but he slid out of his seat and started doing push-ups while the other liberators laughed.
I can help you out, Walt said, unbuckling herself from the seat. There's a small debriefing room behind the bridge. I'm sure General Stacker won't mind if we use it.
Lead the way, Caleb replied.
He got up, following her past the bridge to the small room, which featured a table and six chairs organized behind a terminal and display. He closed the door behind him as they entered.
So how did you end up outside Edenrise during the attack? Walt asked, turning to face him.
General Stacker said you're a centurion?
Tell me when, Caleb. I was tracking the trife, Caleb replied.
He wasn't ready to push her just yet. He wanted to see how she responded to basic questioning.
I followed them north. I was hunting them.
Alone?
Mostly.
But you were a soldier once, that much is obvious. The way you speak. The way you stand.
What about you? How long have you been in Edenrise?
Only about a month. I lost my last home. I was looking for something new to believe in.
And you already made sergeant.
I scored well on their entrance tests. I know I look a little meaty, but I've got moves, she laughed.
Do you want to sit, sir? Caleb pulled out a chair. Walt sat opposite him.
I don't know how much help I can be to you, Colonel. I'm pretty new to the area myself. And with everything that just happened, it's kind of screwed up the established norms.
She's already trying to brush you off.
Fair enough. Maybe you can give me a quick briefing on the rest of the liberators. I don't know any of them. General Stacker pulled us together last minute.
There has to be something of value you can share with me.
Walt shrugged.
I can't think of anything, sir.
Where are you originally from? Caleb asked.
Sir? I'm not sure how that matters.
I'm just trying to get to know my subordinates, starting from the top down. Did you have family in Edenrise?
No, no family. I guess I'm lucky in that.
Do you have family anywhere?
None to speak of, sir.
Any time now, Caleb, this is getting us nowhere.
I feel like you're intentionally stonewalling me, Sergeant. I'm wondering why.
Walt leaned back, eyes narrowing.
Sir, is it a requirement I tell you my life story to be part of this team?
No, but it goes a long way toward earning trust.
And you don't trust me?
Should I?
Yes.
Based on what criteria?
Walt's face flushed.
I'm a member of General Stacker's Liberators. That should imply trust.
You're getting them worked up. I like it. Makes it easier to crack them.
The tattoo on your face, it's an interesting symbol. What does it mean?
It doesn't mean anything. I designed it myself.
You're lying.
Walt's jaw clenched.
How dare you, she hissed, standing up. I don't know who you think you are, but I'm not about to take this bullshit. I
sit down, Caleb said, at the same time Ishek pushed on the Koran inside Walt.
Her eyes widened, and she started to shake as she dropped back into the seat.
You? I'm like you, Caleb said. Only better.
Ishek kept the pressure on the Koran.
I ran into another of your kind when I first arrived here, and I've been bumping into your kind ever since. Who do you serve?
Walt stared at him, trying not to answer. Ishek pushed on the Koran, forcing her to speak.
No one, she replied.
All Koran serve a master, Caleb said. Who do you serve?
She winced as Ishek increased the pressure.
No one, I swear. I used to serve Shirath, but Shirath is gone.
Gone? Caleb asked.
Yes, I don't know where or how. I used to feel him, but not for months.
And you're sure you don't serve Nyarlath?
Walt shook even harder.
No, I was trying to escape her. That's why I came to Edenrise.
What about your hunger? How have you fed it?